I'd like to welcome everyone this evening to Orsamac here in Thornhill. As you see, we have already scheduled next month's lecture on the revealed and hidden concepts of the Messiah, which will be in the Sisterhood Hall, just down the hall from here in this building, where we'll have a little bit more seating. But because of the wedding tonight, we were unable to use a larger room. For those who have not had the opportunity to hear Rabbi Maleski regularly, he does give classes almost every evening on a regular basis, as well as a number of classes during the day for businessmen, lawyers, accountants, all depending on the day. And if you give us a call and the number on your flyer on your calendar, we'll be glad to fill you in on some more specifics. And certainly what the flyer and the calendar have give you some idea of what we're doing during the summer. But there's always new things happening and some things we don't include on there. And I also just wanted to let people know that we've just been able to announce that we will be having, along with the synagogue here, we will be running Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur services through Orsamach that are an educational program, which will offer classes and programs tied into the service for people who are a bit ill at ease at the Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur service, to try to make you feel a little bit more at ease and a little bit more knowledgeable. For you can get information from our office or from the Beth Avraham Yosef office. So at this time, I'd just like to introduce Rabbi Maleski. Of course, Rabbi Maleski was the chief rabbi in Mexico a number of years ago, and since that he went to Jerusalem, where he became one of the most popular lecturers and Orsamach institutions in Jerusalem. He has lectured throughout the world and has become, certainly here, probably one of the most popular lecturers that we have. And I know that I regularly get calls from England, Johannesburg, and just about everywhere asking to have Rabbi Maleski come for a couple of days or a week to lecture to them. So it's always a wonderful opportunity for me to be able to come and hear him speak, and as I'm sure those of you who've heard him before feel the same way. So this evening, just allow me to introduce Rabbi Uziel Maleski.
Okay, on the subject tonight, love and marriage, since we are all experts, so there's very little that I can teach you about it. We're going to be talking about the Torah perspective, what we can derive from Torah ideas concerning the institution of marriage. We live, after all, in a secular society. Our values are extremely influenced with the values that we see on the screen, on the books we read. So, as difficult as it is to function as a Torah faithful Jew in a secular society, when it comes to marriage, there are even more adjustments. Let me just point out a few things, a few differences between the secular, the 20th century approach of marriage and the Torah approach. Let me just point out one simple factor. It's acceptable, it's normal, it's expected that when we define a successful marriage, we ask, are they happily married? And it's such a simple thing, and it's so taken for granted, are they happily married? To many of you, it will come as a surprise that from a Torah perspective, that's not the question that we would ask. We think that we are obsessed with happiness. And what does it mean that we are obsessed with happiness? We see happiness as a goal unto itself. It's very interesting to note how we wish each other in the beginning of a new year. Right? How do we wish each other? Right, January 1st, Happy New Year. Happy New Year. It's very important to note that on Rosh Hashanah, when we say it in Hebrew, we don't say Shana Smechala, Happy Year. We say Shana Tova. And it's significant. It's not a coincidence at all. It reflects a certain point of view of Torah concerning what happiness is all about. Number one, Torah tells you that happiness by itself is not a goal. The goal is Tov, the concept of Tov, of something which is good. There is a goal, and that Tov is a spiritual concept. Tov is associated with the word used by God when He created the world. It says that God looked at this creation and He saw that it was good. And we see in those words, it was good, that it's ready to fulfill its goal, its spiritual goal. So Tov represents a spiritual goal. It's good. It's good. In the secular world, we say, Happy New Year. Because for them, happiness is the goal. And we say that's even impractical. If you are going to make your goal happiness, we believe that you are never going to reach it. Because we believe that by definition, happiness is something that you get as a side product, as a sub-product of a goal that you try to reach. If your life has meaning, if your goal is something special, then we say that in your quest for that goal, in your journey towards that goal, you will feel something inside which we can define as happiness. But happiness is not the goal unto itself. We even think that if a person is constantly asking himself, am I happy? Are we really happy? Are you sure that we are happy? You become miserable trying to find happiness. So that by itself is a tremendous difference between the secular point of view and the Torah point of view. I can describe to you, and I've chosen one of perhaps thousands of passages that you see in books concerning marriages. And here I chose a description of a marriage which the author himself, who is writing a biography, he describes as a very happy marriage. And listen to his description. Quote, "It was wonderful," he says. Wonderful marriage he had. "Each one a person in his own right. Each would go his own way and know that after his or her peccadillos," you know, small transgressions, "the other would still be there. And if not, well, all it would mean, just wait a little while and the other will return. It never failed. We had the perfect marriage. No recrimination, no criticism. We enjoyed each other's company when it was there, and when it was not, it wasn't terribly missed. And after all, there were always potential substitutes." So here he's describing a fantastically happy marriage. When each one it does whatever he wants. I mean, if you are there, okay. And if you are not there, okay. Also, it's also fine. And you do whatever you want. And I do whatever I want. And they are happy. So it does fulfill the secular goal, perhaps, of a happy marriage. But according to us, this is a failed marriage. Because there is no Tov, there is no goodness. It's not a real holy institution, which is what marriage is supposed to be. As a matter of fact, in the Talmud it says, quoting a verse from the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah 41:7, that God blesses the marriage. Ho'omer ladeve, God says to the marriage, Tov, let it be good, not happy. Forget about happiness. Happiness is something that you have to work at. But ideally, it should be Tov, good. It should fulfill a goal. Our view of marriage is better described by thinkers, by rabbis. Like, for instance, the one I'm going to quote right now. The Hasidic, famous Hasidic rabbi, Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev. He says the following. He tries to interpret a passage in the book of Genesis when it says that Isaac, our patriarch Isaac, was presented with his shidduch, with his mate, was found by the servant Eliezer, and he works at it, and he works at it, and eventually it says he brings his wife Rebekah to the tent of his mother, and the oral tradition says that somehow it filled the shoes of his mother, and eventually, vaye'e haveha, eventually he came to love her. Says Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, what do you mean, eventually he came to love her? Why didn't he love her right away? So he says, love is something that you have to work at. It doesn't happen automatically. And that, again, is a tremendous difference with the way the secular world sees love. The way we describe someone as falling in love. You know, when we pay attention to the words, you fall in love. You know what it describes? An accident. Right? You just, you know, you fell down and you hurt yourself. I fell in love. You are describing a state where you are completely passive. Something happens to you. You are the victim of love. What can I do? I fell in love. So you are the poor victim. You can understand me. What can I do? And in a way, we adjust to this concept. And sometimes we even justify things. Well, of course it was the wrong girl, but he fell in love or she fell in love. What can we do? It's like some kind of a disease. Yeah. We never accept this concept. For us, the concept of love is completely different. Rab Levi Yitzchok of Berdichev and another famous Jewish thinker, Rab Dessler, he compares that type of attitude, the secular attitude, as the same as saying, for instance, let's say you love chocolate. You love chocolate. You love vanilla ice cream. So what do with the vanilla ice cream? You take it and you hug it and you kiss it. No, you don't. You don't. So what do? You eat it. So how can you say, I love vanilla ice cream? What you really, really mean is not that you really love vanilla ice cream. You couldn't care less for vanilla ice cream. You love yourself. You love yourself. And you want to give yourself pleasure. And it happens to be that chocolate cake gives you pleasure. So it's not that you are madly in love with that cubic black thing there called chocolate cake. It's you are in love with yourself. And Rav Dessler says very, very often, when we ask the boy and the girl, are you in love with each other? And they say, we are madly in love with each other. What they really mean, we go out and we enjoy ourselves. And we have tremendous times. We have fun. Well, if you have so much fun with the other person, that's being in love. But in reality, is that being in love? Sure, with yourself. Because you are enjoying yourself through the other person. The other person becomes an instrument to your enjoyment, like the vanilla ice cream is an instrument of your enjoyment. That's not real love at all. So what is real love is what Reb Levi Yitzchok of Berdichev says, real love is readiness to give. Real love we derive from the relationship of the Jewish people and God. This is where we derive all the concepts of mutual love. We see, for instance, that for Abraham, the man who established the first God-man relationship, the very intense God-man relationship initiated by man, Abraham was the first one that on his own decided that the fulfillment of man is only through his relationship with God. It says that God tested him. And the final test was his readiness to sacrifice his son. Now, how is that an expression of love? And let's try to understand how sacrifice is so closely connected with the concept of love. The concept of love, according to our tradition, is the establishment of a scale of value. Some things are more important than others. Some people are more important to me than other people. I'm supposed to love everybody, but some people I'm supposed to love more than I love other people. How do I express through my actions the different feelings that I have towards one person as the feelings that I have towards other people? By the readiness to sacrifice. In other words, when the Torah says, love your fellow men, ve'ahavta le'reyacha kamocha, love your fellow men as you love yourself. And the commentaries ask, how does the Torah tell me how to feel? How can the Torah regulate feelings? The Torah can tell me what to do.
The Torah can tell me, yes, to put on phylacteries or not to put on phylacteries. Yes, to eat or not to eat. But how can the Torah tell me how you feel, how to feel? How can the Torah tell me, love someone whom I can't stand? But I'm trying to love him, I just can't stand him. So what does it mean that the Torah tells me, love this person? What it means is that the Torah is telling me that if someone, for instance, as an example, someone you don't like at all asks you for a favor, you are supposed to think the following thought. If I were to love him, would I do it for him? If the answer is yes, then I'm supposed to do it even if I don't like him. In other words, what the Torah is telling me to do is to act in a certain way. So where is the feeling? The Torah tells me that by acting in a certain way, the actions will actually shape the feeling. We always think that the emotions always shape the actions. You love someone, you are acting a certain way. You don't like them, you can't be a hypocrite. We have a completely different insight into hypocrisy. We believe that hypocrisy does not mean when you act in a way that you should act even though you don't feel like it. As a matter of fact, you meet somebody and you tell him, good morning, how are you? Deep inside, it could be that you couldn't care less. Couldn't care less. You know, did it ever happen to you? You ask someone, how are you? Good morning. And he spends the next half hour telling you how he is. Say, come on, you know. That's not exactly what I mean when I say hello, how are you? Because people don't mean what they say. Of course, they don't mean it. So does that mean that you should not say hello, how are you? Not at all. Say it. And be a hypocrite. Why? Because the ideal is that you should act at a certain level, and then you should try to bring up your emotions to the level of your words. In other words, say the right things, act in the right way, and if your emotions are too distant from your words, then don't try to bring down your words to the level of your corrupted emotions. Not at all. Try to keep the level of your words in your actions in a high level. And then try to bring up your emotions to the level of your words and your actions. In other words, when the Torah tells me that you shall love someone, the Torah tells me how to act and eventually allow the emotions to fit those actions. This is the way the Torah defines love. Therefore, according to the Torah point of view, you don't fall in love. So what happens? You choose a person who has the potential of being the receiver of your love. Because since according to us, love is giving, sacrificing, therefore, it's important to choose a person to which it's easier for me to give that feeling, those actions that express my feelings. This is why, when God tells Abraham, in order to establish your scale of values, you have to establish your relationship to me, God. You know that we Jews, we believe in a theocentric system. What does it mean, theocentric? God is the center. It's to such an extreme that we believe in that, that we define a good person, you know how, as a servant of God. That's how we define a good person. It's so God-centered, our religion, our ideology, that everything is measured in terms of how is that related to God. Anything you do. The same way, when Abraham is trying to establish a relationship with God, it's important that he should establish the scale of value. He has to be able to give up everything which is important to him for God. Otherwise, he hasn't established that scale of value. Now, for Abraham, what is the sum total of everything which is important in his life? Obviously, his son. He has been waiting so long for his son. He loves him so much. So his readiness to give up his son for something which is more important is obviously the basis of his relationship with God. It can't be otherwise, except for one thing. God doesn't want human sacrifice. So his intention is sufficient. But the necessity of the offering of the son for the sake of God That's a precondition to the relationship that Abraham has with God. Now, therefore, we can understand what we said before, that for us, marriage is a holy institution. As a matter of fact, the act of getting married is called kiddushin. It creates a holy institution, like the Sabbath is holy, and the Beit HaKnesset is holy, and the Beit HaMikdash is holy, and the land of Israel is holy. Marriage is holy, because it has a holy task, it has a goal. And the goal is to grow spiritually, to allow the presence of God in the household that you are forming. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says so. The Talmud says that that's hinted in the words for man and woman. The word for man is Ish. Aleph, Yud, Shin. And the name for woman is Aleph, Shin, Hey, Isha. And the Talmud says, as long as the Yud of Ish and the letter Hey of Isha, and you know what the letter Yud and the letter Hey make up, the name of God, Ka, Hallelujah, Yud, Hey. As long as the name of God is in the midst of the Ish and the Isha, then you have harmony, you have peacefulness. The moment you take away the Yud of Ish and the Hey of Isha, you know what you have left if you take away the Yud of the word Ish and the Hey of the word Isha? You have Ash and Ash, fire, destructive force. This is the concept behind the holiness of this institution, the institution of marriage. So, what is the main deterrent? What's the main problem to good marriages? Forget about happy marriages, good marriages. What is the biggest enemy? The Talmud says that kosher zivugon, it's so difficult for a marriage to work like it was difficult to split the Red Sea. That's what it says in the Talmud. Kikriyat Yamsuf, like the splitting of the Red Sea. And in the Talmud, it's explained in the following way. According to our tradition, we believe that men and women originally were part of the same common soul. It says that the first man, Adam, that everybody thinks was a male, according to the tradition, he was an entity made up of two sexes, both male and female. He was half male and half female, the original Adam. And what God did was to separate the male side from the female side in order for them to re-encounter, in order for them to come together again. So every time male and female come together, they are ideally going back to that original state of absolute unity, to the original Adam. And that reunion is called, according to our tradition, Zivug Rishon, the ideal pairing, the ideal mate, the perfect soulmate. But because of our flaws, because of our shortcomings, the system became distorted. Ideally, there should be one male for one female, and then they encounter each other, and they create a perfect team, and that's the happy ending to the story. But unfortunately, since we live in an imperfect world, the system became distorted. And it's extremely, extremely difficult for those perfect soulmates to find each other. So, what do we have left? Most often, what we have left is another type of a zivuk. In the Talmud, it's called the zivuk sheni, which means the next best soulmate, which is a relationship that you have to work at. The Talmud calls it lefi ma'asav. It all depends in what you do with it. If you work at it and you are successful, you can make from that zivuk sheni, from that imperfect pairing, a perfect team. But it's not natural. It's not easy. It takes an enormous amount of work. That is the zivuk sheni. So, if you were lucky enough, like the Talmud says concerning the relationship between Jacob and Rachel, that they, right away, they sensed with their prophetic eye With their prophetic intuition, Jacob sensed immediately that Rachel was his perfect soulmate. So he had no doubts whatsoever. He had no uncertainties. He knew they will form the perfect team. But most people aren't so lucky, and therefore they have to work at it. And the biggest enemy is selfishness, because naturally we are selfish. And this is what it means when the Talmud says, Ki kriyat yamsu. It's as difficult to bring people together in a good marriage like it was difficult to split the Red Sea. Because the splitting of the Red Sea was going against the law of gravity. The human parallel to the law of gravity is the law of selfishness. Everybody is interested in his own good. And in order to have a marriage, you have to break such a basic law of humanity. The same way that it was difficult for the law of gravity to be broken. And the waters should create walls so the Jews can pass by. This is as difficult as it is for human beings to break their selfishness and to create such a holy team, the institution of marriage. So, we see, for instance, that when marriages don't work, people come and they say, you know, by now, we don't feel anything at all. We just don't feel anything. It's over. There is no love left. There is no excitement left. It's over. And you feel again that sense of being a victim. You know, like the disease is over, so, you know, what should we stay together for? Again, that is the selfishness. We are not ready to do anything for the sake of the team. As long as the team was working for me, it was giving me pleasure, it was giving me enjoyment, then it was worth it. But now I should give up my enjoyment? I should sacrifice something of my own for the sake of the team? What for? I see no value in it. This is the main problem with marriages today. If the problem is just simply the problem of selfishness. We find today, again, the influence of the culture we live in. We live in a culture where nothing is worth to fix. You know, your toaster breaks. Well, I'm going to go take it to fix. I'll throw it out, right? Paper plates, throw it out. Right? Buy another one. It's not a coincidence that sense, that what do you need this one for? You know, the other one is just as good. Was transferred to marriage too. There is no sense of responsibility. Let's make it work. What for? What for? You can buy another toaster, another Mixmaster, big deal. You know, you need, well, you fell in love with this one, it can be the other one. We in Torah have a very important insight into this sense that, what's the difference, this Mixmaster, why you are in love with this one, I'll buy you another one, which is just as good, and it's a new one. You see, when the Talmud, in the Mishnah, when it defines what's real love, real ahava, it says, real love has to be unconditional. It's difficult to understand. What does it mean, unconditional love? What do you mean? Let's say, for instance, boy meets girl, and let's say the girl is beautiful. Well, you fall in love because the girl is beautiful. So it's based on a reason. Let's say the girl is smart. So you fall in love. The girl is smart. It's based on a reason. What do you mean? Love cannot be based on anything. It says in the commentaries concerning another relationship. And that's the relationship between Jew and the land of Israel. It's also a relationship of love. Right? We have a relationship of love between Jew and God, Jew and Torah, Jew and the land of Israel. Very important relationship. Jew and a land of Israel. And it says concerning the spies. Remember a few weeks ago in the synagogue we read the portion of the spies that they came and they brought the fruits of the land of Israel. And they said, look at the fruits. Fantastic fruits. It's a fantastic land. But, you know, we can do without it. That's what they said, right? The land is fantastic, beautiful, produces tremendous fruits. We can do without it. Those were the 10 bad spies. The two good spies, they didn't bring any fruits at all. They just said the land is good. Now, is that significant? That the bad spies bring the produce of the land. They are proud of the land. And the good ones, the one that give a positive report about the land of Israel, they don't bring anything. So one of the commentaries says there is a very important lesson in that. You see, let's say, for instance, you go visit the land of Israel, right? And then you come back and I ask you, did you like Israel? First time you were there, weren't you impressed? And he says, yes, I loved it. It's beautiful. Did you see, you know, the tremendous wall there, right? The Western Wall. Did you see what a structure it is? I fell in love with the place. You know, where else can you see such a wall? You know, I went to Tiberias, and did you see the sunset on Lake Tiberias? I love this land. So I can tell him, you know, it's very nice. You know, the Western Wall is very impressive. But I can take you to China, and there the wall is even more impressive than the Western Wall, right? Or, you know, you are so impressed with the sunset in the Lake Tiberias, I can take you to Switzerland. And you'll fall in love with Switzerland. Now, is that love? When you say that your love is based on those few things that impressed you so much about the land of Israel, that's not love at all. Same way, let's say boy meets girl, right? And he falls madly in love, and then you ask him, why did you fall in love with her? And he tells you, why? I'll give you 5 reasons why I fell in love with her. She's beautiful, a fantastic cook. She's smart, and she's rich, and she's nice. And, you know, how can you not fall in love with such a girl? So you tell him, you know what? You're right. But you know, I know someone, right, that's even more beautiful. And she's even smarter. She's a higher IQ and she, you know, and she's even richer. So what about if your reaction is, well, that's so? Okay, I'll drop this one. I'll take yours. I mean, that's logical. If you said that you fell in love because of these 5 reasons, so if I can give you better reasons to fall in love with somebody else, it's logical that you should fall in love with somebody else. Do you hear the parallel between that and what the bad spy said? The land of Israel is fantastic. Look at the fruits. That's conditional love. That is not real love. What did the other 2 spies said? Forget about the reasons. Our love goes beyond the reasons. And that's a crucial point in Judaism. Eventually, for whatever reasons you fell in love for, real love has to go beyond, it has to transcend the reasons why you fell in love. Let's say, for instance, you fell in love with someone because he's handsome, she's beautiful, and then something tragic happens. And the man becomes disfigured, or the woman loses a leg or something. And she's not so beautiful and physically attractive anymore. Can you still love that person? If you say no, then you don't know what love is. If you say no, then your original love was conditional. The Talmud says conditional love, love based on a reason, is not real love. Perhaps the reason can ignite the love, but the love has to go beyond the reason. It has to transcend the reason. Therefore, we believe in the relationship between Jew and the land of Israel. If you love the land of Israel for 10 reasons, forget it. You don't love the land of Israel. If God loves the Jewish people because the Jewish people are good and fine and nice, then it's not real love. It says that in the daily prayer we say that God is very close to the Jewish people. Zocher chasdei avot, he remembers our forefathers, but umevi goel livnei bneihem. No matter how long God waits, he will still have ahava, he will still be in love with the Jewish people. Why? No reason. Perhaps his relationship with our forefathers ignited the love, it started the love, but eventually, no matter what we do, that love is there. It's unconditional. And this is the definition of love according to the Mishnah, according to the Talmud. So, if we are going to try to give some advice according to our sources, what advice would we give couples? How to improve their marriage? Obviously, I'm not talking to you, but to people outside, right? I mean, marriages need help. The divorce rates are growing. We know that there is a major, major problem. So there are certain things that can be improved. Certain things can be done in a better way. We find in our sources a tremendous stress in the individuality of every human being. Every person was created different than everybody else. The Talmud says the same way that no two people look the same, no two people are the same or think the same way, and no two people have the same obligations towards God. Each one has his own obligation. Of course, there is a basic requirement that the Torah gives us, and above that, each one has to find his own way to find God. This is why it says in the song of praise that Moshe and the Jewish people sing after the crossing of the Red Sea, it says, Ze keili ve'anevehu. Elokei avi varomemenu. I have two relationships with God. The relationship which is based on my tradition, because my father was Jewish and my grandfather was Jewish, then I'm also Jewish. But then, besides that, there is a very personal relationship which is only mine and no one else's. And one of the most important things in human relations is recognizing what the other person is. And we know very, very well that one of the main problems is in marriage is how one mate tries to reshape the other mate in its own image. And that, as a rule, never, ever works. And it comes from that lack of sensitivity, lack of awareness of what the other person is. The Tzelem Elohim, how it was created in God's image, and perhaps all its characteristics are not exactly the way I would define the ideal human being. But that is what we are supposed to do in marriage. Be ready to accept the other person as the other person is. Don't try to reshape the other person. Another very important piece of advice that we find in our sources. It's called in our literature, Hakarat HaTov. Let me tell you what it really means. Today we would call it lower your expectations. Very, very difficult. Lower your expectations. In our culture, we are trained to maximize our expectations. Right? Well, let's say you see an ad in the newspaper, on television. You think you have a good car, right? I'll offer you a better car. Your car isn't good, I need a better car, right? You think you have a good relationship. Here, this is a good relationship, the perfect relationship. Just smoke a Marlboro and then you'll have, you know, a perfect relationship. They are always telling you how your life is not perfect at all. You want a perfect life? Just look at this couple, look at this car, look at this people who travel throughout the world. You are always told about how unhappy you really are and how ideal that imaginary world that they present to you. They always try to raise your expectations. And you know what the human reaction is to raise expectations? Frustration and unhappiness. Because you will never be like that couple on television. And your car, as good as it is, there is always going to be another car that's going to be better than yours. And you fall short of the ideal. So therefore, there is always reason to be unhappy. Therefore, you never have hakarat hatov. You never have a sense of gratitude, of appreciation. What about if you lower your expectations? What about if you say that we are not born with rights? Because in the secular world, that's what we believe. We are born with a right to happiness. Who says that you are born with a right of happiness? The point is that if you believe that you are born with a right to happiness, so if I'm not 100% happy, then I can criticize the whole world, right? I can. What do you mean? I'm not being given what's rightfully mine. It's not so at all. You never made a contract with anybody. God never signed a contract that you will be 100% happy in your life. So lower your expectations. Train yourself not to expect anything. Therefore, whatever is given to you will be a pleasant surprise. And lo and behold, all of a sudden you'll start experiencing happiness if you lower your expectations. Very, very often, we find that when people fight, people have fights, happens, best of families. Very, very often we find that when you quarrel, what is the real cause is not anything that the other person did or said or is. Very often, it's the dissatisfaction with what you are. You are dissatisfied with yourself. So, if a person can come to terms with himself, he will find something miraculous, that all of a sudden that other person, the mate, is much more tolerable, much more acceptable. Because very, very often, all you are doing is expressing your unhappiness with yourself. So what is the goal? What is the rectification? What is the solution? We think we have the answer. We think that that the right answer is that a life that has meaning, a life that has substance, is a life that makes you more satisfied. Eventually, it will make you happier, even though that's not your goal, but as a subproduct for doing something which has real value, all of a sudden, you look at yourself and say, hey, I'm happy. I'm doing something positive. So, there is no substitute for looking for meaning. Looking for something which will satisfy not only your physical side, but something that will satisfy your spiritual side. Because we have a very simple rule. Everything which is basically physical is temporary. Only spiritual relationships are eternal. You know very well that in marriage, one of the most important laws is the separation between men and women during certain periods of the month. There is such a practical purpose for no other reason. Let's say, forget about the spiritual side of it. If for no other reason, what it does is that it focuses on the part of the relationship which is spiritual. Obviously, if you are forced to keep away physically from each other, then even against your will, you'll have to focus on the spiritual side of the other person. You have no choice. And all of a sudden, you'll start finding in the other person aspects, sides that you never knew. Why? Because you are forced to find other sides in the other person. It's not only physical. Therefore, we believe that a relationship that is only based on physical attraction is bound to fail if it doesn't go beyond that. Because everything physical, like we said, is temporary. It will go by, it will pass, and eventually it will disappear. Therefore, the Torah forces us to, in a way, ignore the physical side for a certain portion of the month. And by focusing on something not physical, all of a sudden we'll develop something which is eternal, and it's guaranteed to improve your marriage. Thank you very much. Any questions? Any comments? Absolutely, it's no contradiction. When we say lower expectations, we mean mostly from others and from the surroundings. In other words, don't expect that other person to be perfect towards you. Don't expect the world to be extremely nice to you and give you everything you want, right? So, from outside of you, externally, lower expectations. As far as yourself is concerned, that is another subject. I'm not going to say you should raise your expectations, but you, towards yourself, you have to have a balance between rising expectations and lower. Goal is, but there is a goal, and you work towards the goal, and you measure your success according to how close you came to the goal you set for yourself. That is how a marriage should be measured, not by how happy you are, right? Not how many vacations or how many cars you have, basically. Of your marriage? You mean in a spiritual sense? Okay. In a spiritual sense, you, towards yourself, right, as far as you are concerned, you're supposed to have very high expectations of yourself, spiritually. Again, from others, don't expect too much, and you'll be happily surprised every time something good happens. Yeah. Okay, of course, we didn't go into that. Of course, that's a major subject of discussion, right? And we believe that a boy and a girl who are going to get married, the main subject should be not, right, what, you know, what cars to buy and where, you know, what kind of carpets to have in the house, but values, because we believe that one of the main problems is that boy and girl don't really know each other, because most things that they discuss are trivial. You know what they say? You know why people get divorced for the most trivial reasons? Because they get married for the most trivial reasons. Of course, they get divorced for more trivial reasons. Because the reality is that people don't discuss real important matters. So if you don't even know your mate, most of the times you don't really know. You don't really discuss what's the goal of life, right? And what's really important. The concept of human responsibility. Those things aren't discussed most of the times. So you don't really know the other person. And most of the times, right? You get up in the morning and you say, hey, that's not the person, you know, I went out with. Right? It's another person. And it is, because you didn't really know him. Because we don't discuss the real goal of life. So, of course, boy and girl have to get together and discuss what is going to be the goal of their lives and how are they going to achieve it. And if their goals don't coincide, by all means, don't get married. Absolutely. There are guidelines, not exact guidelines, but there are guidelines. I intentionally didn't go into this subject tonight because it's a subject unto itself. What is the Torah point of view concerning the role of the man and the role of the woman? Okay? There are guidelines, but they are very, very flexible guidelines. Eventually, in some future lecture, we are going to be discussing it. The guidelines are very flexible, and it depends on every individual, and the couple has to find the right guidelines for their own marriage. And they can't look at somebody else's marriage and say, well, that is the right division of labor. That's not true at all. It all depends in your nature and your mate's nature. And according to your own characteristics, you have to define what your roles are. But definitely the Torah does give you overall guidelines, right, concerning the role of the man and the role of the woman. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Good night.